Carol Ann Duffy, the poet laureate, was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week Michael's guest will be the actress Celia Imrie. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
The electric telegraph and the telephone, the electric light bulb, the typewriter, these might seem more useful, but the phonograph will become the instrument and shrine of music and poetry.
It's May 1889.
Would you consider recording a few poems on my phonograph?
My secretary deals with things of this sort.
Come on, sir, say yes.
The poet laureate Alfred Lord Tennyson stands before a newfangled phonograph machine.
The man is undoubtedly a genius.
Good Lord, I never thought of him in that way.
He takes a deep breath.
Over 600 stanzas of 4 lines each.
Couldn't you choose a few highlights?
And recites a poem. Tennyson and Edison.
The phonograph is a form of afterlife. Recorded sound as an ear on the infinite.
The next drama on 3, tonight at 8:30.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Susan Ray.
The Queen's Diamond Jubilee Flotilla is moving into its final formation before setting sail along the River Thames this afternoon. 1,000 boats and ships of all shapes and sizes, from steamboats to rowing boats, are taking part in the largest river pageant held in London for more than 300 years. The Queen will be seated on a royal barge, covered in garlands of flowers from her gardens. David Cameron has paid tribute to her, saying that she is 100% dedicated and doing an amazing job. President Assad of Syria has said he will continue to confront terrorism and that a foreign plot is trying to destroy the country. Speaking to the country's parliament in Damascus, he denied that his forces were involved in the massacre in the town of Houla last month, in which more than 100 men, women and children were killed. A British-based campaign group says 57 soldiers were killed in Syria yesterday, the highest number of casualties suffered by the military since the uprising began more than a year ago. David Cameron has defended the U-turns on tax which have been announced since the budget. He said it took courage for a government to admit that it was ploughing into a brick wall and change course. He insisted ministers still had the necessary resolve, strength and grit. Hundreds of people are occupying Tahrir Square in the Egyptian capital Cairo after protests overnight about the trial of the former president Hosni Mubarak. Demonstrators are angry that Mubarak and his interior minister were not given the death sentence for their part in the killing of protesters during last year's uprising. The American Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is visiting a former US naval base in Vietnam, a day after he announced that the bulk of the US Navy would be stationed in the Pacific. He's the most senior American official to visit Cam Ranh Bay since the end of the Vietnam War, in a sign of growing military cooperation between the two countries. And the weather, Scotland and Northern Ireland will be dry but chilly with some sunshine. It'll also feel cooler across the rest of the UK with the possibility of heavy showers. And that's the BBC News and Weather.
And so to the early music show, which is introduced by Catherine Bott.
Hello, don't turn off the radio. This is the Early Music Show and there's method in my madness. When Queen Elizabeth II came to the throne in 1952, many hopeful parallels were made with the reign of an earlier Queen Elizabeth, also an attractive young princess, serious of purpose, who hadn't been born to be queen and head of the established church, but who assumed her role with grace and intelligence when the day came. So in the 1950s, Good Queen Bess became an understandable source of interest for historians and musicians alike, including Benjamin Britten, whose opera Gloriana, actually premiered at coronation time in 1953, focuses on the Virgin Queen's relationship with the Earl of Essex. The opera was based on the 1928 book Elizabeth and Essex by Lytton Strachey, who specialised in writing about English queens. But the name Gloriana was originally coined by Edmund Spenser in his allegorical poem written to please Elizabeth, the Fairy Queen. It would be unwise to make any claim for the 1950s as a key decade in the revival of early music in this country. That had been underway for some years. but thanks to the optimism surrounding our new young queen, it was a time when more and more people started to take an interest in all things Elizabethan, like the Triumphs of Oriana, a collection of English madrigals from 1601, assembled in honour of Elizabeth I. Canzone Antiqua, singing Long Live Fair Oriana by Ellis Gibbons from The Triumphs of Oriana, that glorious early example of doing as Disraeli later recommended. Everyone likes flattery, he said, and when you come to royalty, you should lay it on with a trowel. In today's Early Music Show, I'm looking at some of the music and musicians who helped to bring medieval, Renaissance and Baroque music into the forefront of the music scene during the 1950s. We've already heard that Benjamin Britten threw himself into the past with his opera Gloriana and with some of his realisations of songs by Purcell. And it was Purcell who also provided inspiration for musicologist Walter Bergman and his friend composer Michael Tippett.
If music be the food of love, sing on, sing on, sing on, sing on till I am filled. Am filled with joy, for then my listening soul you move, for then my listening soul you move to pleasures that can never cloy. Your eyes, your mien, your tongue declare that you are music again.
Purcell's If Music Be the Food of Love, edited by Michael Tippett and Walter Bergman, and performed on that recording by tenor Martin Hill and pianist Andrew Ball. Bergman, a German wartime immigrant, was trained as a lawyer, but his legal qualifications were no use to him in Britain, so he decided to see if he could make a career as a continuo player. And at Morley College in South London, he met his future collaborator, Michael Tippett. Pause for a spot of extramural history here. From 1940 to 51, Tippett was director of music at Morley College, a place which should have more of a fuss made of it. It had been founded in the 1880s as the Morley Memorial College for Working Men and Women, endowed financially by an enlightened MP, Samuel Morley, and run initially by Emma Conns, the woman who created the Old Vic Theatre. Among Tippett's predecessors at Morley had been Holst and Vaughan Williams, both of them interested in English music of the past, even if it wasn't strictly what we would call early music. Here's the musicologist and biographer Anne Martin.
Morley College was an extraordinary place during the Second World War. It was where many musical refugees collected together under Michael Tippett. Michael Tippett had an extraordinary ability to mix professional and amateur musicians together. And Walter Bergman got involved in all of this. When Michael Tippett was imprisoned as a pacifist during the war, Walter Bergman took over some of the choir rehearsals. He started recorder classes at Morley College. And together, extraordinary musical performances went on because during the Second World War, apart from Myra Hess's concerts, there was very little musical activity. And so Morley College offered an outlet for both professional and amateur players, and also the extraordinary number of talented refugees from Germany.
Anne Martin, biographer of Walter Bergman. Bergman and Tippett edited a number of Purcell's songs for publication by Schott, and that volume played a significant role in the initial revival of the countertenor voice in the person of Alfred Deller. Bergman became Deller's harpsichordist of choice, and they performed and recorded together a great many times. You may have heard the very recent edition of the Early Music Show celebrating the art of Alfred Deller on the centenary of his birth. Here's a recording that we didn't play in that programme. Deller, accompanied on the harpsichord by Walter Bergman, singing Purcell's Music for a While.
Thank you.
Alfred Deller, Walter Bergman and Henry Purcell. There's a whole generation who discovered Purcell songs through Deller, Tippett and Bergman. And there's another composer who should be grateful to Bergman for his rise in popularity. Here's Anne Martin again.
One of Walter Bergman's great interests was Telemann. During the 1950s, Telemann was seen as an inferior, distinctly inferior composer to Bach and Handel. Now, the volume of music that he produced is absolutely enormous, but Walter Bergman knew that a very large part of it was very fine music and worth reviving. And so during the 1950s, Bergman worked hard to try to establish him as a reputable composer with music worth performing. And as early as 1953 at Morley College, he arranged a performance with Ilse Wolf of Telemann's cantata Ino and of the opera Pimpinoni. But it wasn't until the 1960s that Telemann really became respectable, but a lot of that was due to Walter Bergman's work.
As we heard earlier, Walter Bergman also ran a recorder class at Morley College. A dedicated bunch of amateur players maintained a lively interest in that instrument throughout the war years, and when the Society of Recorder Players was reformed in 1946, there was quite a nucleus of players on which to build. Bergman was one of the Society's musical directors all through the 1950s, and via his editing and printing of recorder music and his deep interest in musical education, he was able to advise many young artists and create opportunities for them to perform. Someone who helped him in this noble work was the young Franz Brüchen. Bergman arranged for him to visit London in the 50s to give masterclasses and concerts so that young players could benefit from his exceptional talent. This is Brüchen now, playing music by the most famous Dutch recorder player of the 17th century, Jacob van Eyck.
Thank you.
Franz Brüchen, the first superstar recorder virtuoso. Anyone remember that LP cover with him in a cricket jumper? Playing The Angel's Little Nightingale by the 17th century composer Jakob van Eyck. In the mid-1950s, when he came to London at the invitation of Walter Bergmann, Brüchen was only in his early 20s and already appointed professor at the Royal Conservatory in The Hague. It has to be said that Holland was slightly ahead of the UK in taking early music seriously, but at the dawn of a new Elizabethan age, British recorder players owed Walter Bergmann quite a lot. Now you're wondering, I expect, about the name I haven't yet mentioned in the 20th century history of the recorder, viol and lute, Arnold Dolmetsch. Well, that extraordinary pioneer died in 1940, 12 years before the Queen came to the throne. But his legacy as a proselytiser of early music and as a scholar, player and maker of instruments. I've still got a couple of plastic Dolmetsch recorders somewhere, with just the faintest of tooth marks here and there on their beaks. Dolmetsch's legacy was continued by his children, particularly the recorder player Carl, and players, scholars and makers. The musicologist and viol player Robert Donington studied and worked with Arnold at his workshop and at the Dolmetsch Festival in Haslemere. As well as writing a number of books on early music performance practice, Donington was one of the best viola da gamba players in the country. He'd played in the English Consort of Viols in the mid-1930s, and from 1950 to 60, he was a member of the London Consort of Viols. Here's a recording from 1957 of them playing a pavan and galliard by Peter Phillips. Recorded in 1957, that was the London Consort of Viols playing the Pavan and Galliard Paget by Peter Phillips. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, a special Diamond Jubilee look at early music in the 1950s, when, according to the great Nigel Molesworth, every child was a young Elizabethan. Look it up. In 1956, Robert Donington also set up his own ensemble, aptly named the Donington Consort. But he's perhaps most widely known today as a Wagner scholar. It is allowed, you know. He was certainly one of the most influential early music instrumentalists of the time, and really helped to put early string music on the map again. Here's the London Consort again, with a Pavan by John Oakover. Oakover's Pavan for Five Viols, played by the London Consort of Viols, among them Robert Donington. Another vital name in 1950s early music was that of Thurston Dart, like Walter Bergman, a keyboard player and music scholar who believed passionately in striking the right balance between performing and scholarship. He was one of the most effective supporters of the early music revival in Britain. As a performer, Dart was equally accomplished on any of the early keyboard instruments, from harpsichord to organ. Let's hear him playing the clavichord now in a recording of one of Froberger's Fantasias.
Thank you.
Thurston Dart playing Froberger on the clavichord. As a teacher, Dart had a tremendous influence on succeeding generations. One of his most distinguished students, Christopher Hogwood, spoke fondly of him in a Radio 3 programme called Behind the Mask, recorded nearly 20 years ago.
He was a player at that time when elaborate and rather ear-catching continuo parts were very much the order of the day. He was an exponent of extemporising, though, and this, I think, was what most impressed the people around him, was that he would do it differently every time, and he was constantly very at ease with singers particularly. He loved voices and was a great accompanist and a very, very fluent keyboard player. I turned pages for him for performances of Matthew Passion, for example, and the fun was not only seeing it all happening one night, but being able to lean close to the keyboard and see it happening different the second night and ask, you know, how do you do all that impromptu? My dear sir, just follow the second violins, you'll be safe. And little tips. And some cleverness was too clever by half, and quite a lot of that style of playing is very much of its own period. And I think many players now would opt for a more austere manner. But some of the ideas and the panache with which they were delivered, I think, were wonderful. And I think once I had heard his recording of Kvyafech, the aria that I'd seen Ivor Keys doing years ago in the Bach Magnificat, and noted that what Bach had suggested in that, that it's he's made me mighty, could be interpreted by the continuo player as a challenge to take a small germ idea and build it up into something mighty. Any continuo player will do it, because you're adding something to a small germ. What Dart saw was that one of the ploys you could use on that little theme, motto theme, at the end of the aria was to use it in canon, and nobody else had spotted, I think, this canonic idea. One likes to think that Bach himself would not have missed it, since it was there, and it's done with such exuberance. I find it very hard to play the piece myself nowadays without just going back and harking on what Dart extemporised.
Thomas Hemsley was the baritone soloist in the aria Quia Fecit from Bach's Magnificat, with the Geraint Jones Orchestra, including Thurston Dart on the harpsichord, extemporising away very fruitily at the end. As I mentioned earlier, Thurston Dart was a music scholar as well as a performer, and in the 1950s, one composer in particular caught his imagination, partly because of his wonderful music, but also because of his colourful life. Here's Dart on a radio programme from the depths of the BBC archive, expatiating on a favourite subject, John Bull.
According to an old story, Bull wrote the tune that we in England know as the National Anthem, a tune that's spread over half the world. I don't think I need play it. No one's ever seen the piece of music upon which this claim of Bull's is based. A year or so ago, I came across an early 19th century copy of it, a piece of music called God Save the King. This is how it begins. And so on and so on. The whole piece of music consists of variations on that tune repeated over and over again, ending with a grand climax. Well, that's got nothing to do with the tune we know today. There's a final bit of evidence. The same manuscript that once contained that bit of music also contained another bit by Bull, called a galliard. No one's ever seen the manuscript. It disappeared 75 years ago. But I'm going to play a copy which was made of this piece before the manuscript disappeared. Here it is. Did Bull write that tune that we know so well?
Thurston Dart with an intriguing detective story surrounding one of his pet topics, the life and music of John Bull. One of the most important contributions that Dart made to the early music revival during the 1950s was as one of the founders of Musica Britannica, the authoritative national collection of British music, which began life in 1951. It was designed to stand alongside existing library editions and to explore the vast heritage of material still largely untouched by them, so making available a representative survey of the British contribution to music in Europe. Last year, for the Early Music Show, I asked Professor Julian Rushton, one of the current editors, to explain exactly what the aim of Musica Britannica had been.
The original aim was expressed, somewhat unfashionably nowadays, as publication of the classics of our music, but excluding certain composers who were going to get privileged treatment, that is, collected editions of their own works. Henry Purcell is an obvious case. We have lots by his contemporary John Blow and nothing by Purcell himself. But the aim was to make this material widely available for libraries, for study, and also, critically, for performance. So among those who have served Musica Britannica on the committee and as editors have not only been academics, but also those who have played the music in public, and the first secretary, Thurston Dart, is of a case in point.
Julian Rushton. Well, the first edition of Musica Britannica in 1951 was the Mulliner Book of Keyboard Music from the mid-16th century. But I thought, since we've had rather a lot of harpsichords in today's programme, we should hear something from one of the later editions. In the late 50s, Frank Harrison worked on the Eton Choir Book, a vast collection of English sacred choral music from the early 16th century. Musica Britannica published the whole thing in three volumes. Here's an Ave Maria by William Cornish. The 16, directed by Harry Christophers, with an Ave Maria by William Cornish, from the 10th volume of Musica Britannica, that invaluable resource begun around the time of the Festival of Britain, the year before the accession of Queen Elizabeth, and still going strong in 2012, as indeed is Her Majesty. One of the other co-founders of Musica Britannica was the conductor and composer Anthony Lewis. He was on the music staff of the BBC during World War II and in 1953 edited Musica Britannica Volume 7, John Blow's Coronation and Verse Anthems. As we heard from Julian Rushton earlier, Purcell hasn't been included in Musica Britannica, but Anthony Lewis was something of a Purcell specialist. ¶¶ Anthony Lewis conducting the Orchestra of the Philharmonia of London in music from Purcell's King Arthur. This weekend sees the big celebrations marking 60 years of a new Elizabethan age. Early music's come on a lot since 1952, but those words from Purcell and Dryden's King Arthur ring as true now as they did then. Fairest isle, all isles excelling, seat of pleasure and of love.
Today's Early Music Show was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Salford by Les Pratt. On next Saturday's programme, Lucy Skeeping will be presenting the first concert in our coverage of this year's Lufthansa Festival of Early Music in London. Miniature operas from 17th century Venice, given by Ensemble Savadi.
From a single voice to a spectacular 60-part Anne's Day. For the week of the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, a glorious programme of outsized pieces of Renaissance and early Baroque polyphony, live from the Bath Festival. Including Talis's Sperminalium and the work that inspired it. Radio 3, live in concert, Tuesday night on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30.
Well, now it's time for our Sunday concert, which was recorded at this year's Newbury Spring Festival. The pianist, Stephen Huff, plays sonatas by Beethoven, Scriabin and Liszt, as well as a composition of his own, at Newbury Corn Exchange. Louise Fryer is the presenter.
The town of Newbury is in festival mode. Its gracious buildings and churches have been bursting with talks and performances, exploring the twin themes of this year's festival, British tradition and international youthful excellence. Here at the Corn Exchange, we have the chance to experience the best of British when it comes to playing and composing for the piano, as well as writing extensively about music and theology in the shape of Stephen Huff. Acknowledged as one of the most distinctive pianists of his generation, Stephen will be performing one of his own pieces, Broken Branches, alongside works by Scriabin, Liszt and Beethoven. Strange Sonatas is Stephen's theme, so if a sonata can be summed up as a serious, wordless piece, I asked him earlier how he defines strange.
Well, it's all sonatas that don't fit the normal mode of what we think of as the classical sonata. The sort of number of movements, whether it's four movements of the earlier classical sonatas or three movements of the later classical sonatas. And in a way, none more strange than the Moonlight Sonata, which is the most famous sonata probably ever written, because it begins with an improvisation. And I think it's interesting to think that at the time of Beethoven, it was unheard of for a pianist to sit down at the piano and start playing a piece. You sat down and you began to warm up a little bit, improvise a little, play a few chords, play a few arpeggios, and indeed that's what the Moonlight Sonata is. It's warming up with some arpeggios. But you hear this actually on recordings, even of concerts in the 20th century, and really until after the Second World War, this was what people did. And Liszt, whose great sonata is also on this program, he used to talk to his students about the best way to prelude a verb meaning to preamble the piece you're going to play. So this is an interesting thing, and I think this sonata, if you think of it like that, that it's something that comes out of a sense of improvisation, it has a very different feeling from that familiar Moonlight Sonata, here we go, piece that everyone knows so well.
And in terms of being a composer, why would you want to go to the sonata form, which seems to have lost its kind of fashionability, if you like?
Well, I think it's a little bit like the sonnet or other forms that have had a very fruitful history. It's nice to feel that you can go back to those templates and work with them. I think the idea of sonata, though, for me, is a journey. It's material that returns, and it returns, but you've changed when you hear it again. And I think all the great sonatas have this feeling that you've heard that before, and yet there's something different about it.
And do you like the sense that the audience is undertaking that journey with you?
Yes, I mean, that's the reason we're here. It's a little bit like being a train driver and no one in the carriages. You know, you do want to feel that someone's there with you.
Stephen Huff, who begins this recital with Beethoven, the sonata in C-sharp minor, opus 27, number 2, billed as a sonata quasi una fantasia, though it's more commonly known by that shorter and more evocative title, The Moonlight Sonata, after one of Beethoven's friends associated the opening with a moonlit night on Lake Lucerne. Although it begins peacefully enough with a gentle, mysterious lucidity, little waves whip up until the third movement brings a veritable storm. And here comes Stephen Hough taking his place on stage here at the Corn Exchange in Newbury to play Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata.